believe. It's time to sit up and to pay attention to Jesus and to accept that he really is a prophet ordained by God. He speaks for God. We should listen. And when he says that God is about to act, we should do it. Believe. Is there anything else we should do? Was there anything else? And of course, that's what our paragraph is about today. That's something else that people needed to do. And it had to do with this, this notion of apprenticeship. It's time to start an apprenticeship with Jesus. And so in this paragraph of Mark's gospel, it was first revealed that Jesus moved to a remote corner of Herod's kingdom, Galilee. Many of you are aware of the general geography of the Holy Land. Way up at top, we have the Sea of Galilee. There's the Sea of Galilee, and down at the bottom, we have the Dead Sea, and then that long, narrow, windy river, the Jordan River. Jesus was up to the north, far away from important people, far away from where important decisions were being made. And here, even though he said God was about to act, God was about to intervene, some kind of salvation was about to happen, rather than going to, you know, Capitol Hill, he withdraws into the wilderness, almost, and along the shores of the Sea of Galilee, and he begins to do his work of recruiting people. Many of you know about the Sea of Galilee. Some of you have been there. I don't know if any of you have swum there. Usually people swim in the Dead Sea. Some satellite imagery of the Sea of Galilee. It's not very big. It's about 13 miles long, 6-7 miles wide. It's about 700, 800 feet below sea level, which is kind of strange. I would love to see it. I've never been there. I know a number of you have. Let's go to the next slide. I really like this one. This is the one that makes me feel like peeling my shirt off and running down to the shore and diving in. This is where Jesus went. This is where Jesus began to model what that other thing was that people ought to do, because God was poised to act. He was ready to work a work of salvation. He went to a part of the country that had a thriving industry of commercial fishing. Some of you are fishermen. I thought I knew a little bit about fishing, but then I moved to Nova Scotia and I found out that there are people who do big scale fishing. This is commercial fishing. In those days, there was a thriving commercial fishery on the Sea of Galilee. There were 16 bustling ports in the first century on Galilee. About 70, 80 years later, when Josephus, the Jewish historian, who was in cahoots with the Romans, and they needed to quickly put together a little armada on the Sea of Galilee, he was able to round up over 200 boats because there was so much fishing, and fishing, of course, involves boats, among other things. Fish was the staple in that part of the world, and often the fish from Galilee were shipped to as far away as Egypt. And so Jesus went to a place that had fishermen who fished, and they knew all about fishing. And he adapted his language. He had a message that he wanted to communicate to them, and fishermen would understand it. So let me actually get you to turn to Mark 1, and let's read this passage, beginning at verse 16, where Jesus begins to talk about the whole notion of apprenticeship. I recently have met some young men. I have a nephew who's just graduated from high school. He's trying to figure out his life and what's in the future, and he is about to embark on an electrical apprenticeship. This was an electrical apprenticeship, but it was an apprenticeship. And so Mark writes in Mark 1, verse 16, reading from the NIV, "As Jesus walked beside the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and his brother Andrew casting a net into the lake, for they were fishermen." I think I have a slide of the net that they used. Can we bring that one up? Yeah, these were round nets, not some of the other nets that we sometimes think of. So Simon and his brother Andrew were casting nets just like that into the lake, for they were fishermen. So now Jesus tells them the third thing that people need to do because God was about to act. He said, "Come, follow me, and I will send you out to fish for people." At once they left their nets and followed him. When he had gone a little farther, he saw James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John in a boat preparing their nets. Without delay, he called them, and they left their father Zebedee in the boat and the hired men and followed him. It's funny how when you read the Bible, you read it through the lens of your age or your experience. Some of you may have seen the movie A River Runs Through It. I think I have a slide. The movie's good, but in this case, I think the book was even better. And this is how the book begins. In our family, the author writes, there was no clear line between religion and fly fishing. We lived at the junction of great trout rivers in western Montana, and our father was a Presbyterian minister and a fly fisherman who tied his own flies and taught others. He told us about Christ's disciples being fishermen, and we were left to assume, as my brother and I did, that all first-class fishermen on the Sea of Galilee were fly fishermen, and that John the Favorite was a dry fly fisherman. Now, some of you may know the world of fly fishing, but we often read the Bible through the lens of our own age or our experience. But today we read a passage about something that maybe we know very little about. Some of us here are fishermen. I've heard you tell stories about fish and stuff. But it was to people like this, real people, business people, people who were involved in the commercial fishery. Jesus came and he called them with the words, "Come follow me." What did he mean by that? What was he doing as he used that language? Well, I want to look at it through a lens of three things. First of all, Jesus was calling people, but he was calling people to himself. Jesus was making himself the issue. One of the things that he was doing was he was breaking with rabbinic tradition. In those days, if you wanted to be part of a rabbi school, the rabbi didn't come looking for you. You went looking for the rabbi of your choice. It was sort of an adopt-a-rabbi approach. You had to find your own rabbi. Jesus didn't do it that way. He took the initiative. He took the first step. He went looking for people, and he called them to be his own apprentices. Jesus broke with rabbinic tradition. Reminds me of a scene in a movie that I saw a number of years ago. There was a young guy who was living on the West Coast in California. And like many kids his age, his name was Jay, his dream was to become a surfer. And he just didn't want to just surf the little waves. He wanted to surf the big granddaddy waves, the maverick waves. And there weren't very many people who could do this. But there was a man in his community, and he was a legend. I mean, he was a guy who surfed the biggest and the best of all the waves. His name was Frosty. But Frosty didn't really want to train anybody. And this guy pestered him a little bit, but he didn't seem to be working. Well, one day, Jay was working in the pizza parlor where he had a part-time job, and his mind wasn't on his work, and his boss knew it. And that day, in fact, his boss said to him, "Where are you? You haven't been here ever since you got here." And, of course, he's dreaming about these great waves that he's going to surf. And all of a sudden, he notices just outside the pizza parlor, there's this van. You know, one of those California surfing vans. And it's Frosty. And he's honking his horn. And he's kind of, you know, gesturing to him. And so Jay drops what he's doing. He's halfway through making a pizza. And he runs out there and his boss scolds him. "What are you doing?" And he and Frosty have a conversation. Actually, it was more of a monologue. And this is what the master surfer said. "Okay, here's the deal. I'm going to train you. No questions, no arguing, end of story. I teach you what you need to know. You got it? Meet me in my shed tomorrow morning, 6:30 a.m. Not 6:31, not 6:32. And then he drives off. And this young man just entered into a surfing apprenticeship with the legend Frosty. Well, I don't know if the disciples felt that way when Jesus approached them. But he made himself the issue. You will follow me. It was an exercise. It was an expression of his authority. He made it personal. He didn't simply call people to a creed. He didn't say, "Here, I've got a little pamphlet of what I believe. I want you to read it and see if you want to be my disciple." It wasn't about a creed. Now, Jesus had a creed. And later on in the Gospel of Mark, Jesus will summarize his creed. Somebody will come to Jesus and say, "Okay, there's a lot of material in the Old Testament. There's over 600 commandments. Of all those 600 commandments, what is it that really matters?" And he distills it on the spot. He boils it down to its irreducible minimum, and he says, "Here's the creed." And you may remember that story, and we'll study that in maybe a couple of months. And it wasn't so much an institution. Jesus didn't call people to an institution. Although there are many institutions that arose from the ministry and the life and the death and the resurrection of Jesus. And so we're not against institutions and we're not against creeds, but Jesus didn't first and foremost call people to that. Can you imagine if somebody got married and they thought they were marrying an institution? We were at a wedding yesterday. A couple said their vows, took off on their honeymoon, and this morning they woke up. They woke up. They didn't wake up to an institution. They woke up to a person. The heart of marriage is a personal relationship. There are creeds. There is kind of a creedal basis for marriage. I mean, there are these vows that are exchanged, so there is a real content. But woe to the man who thinks that he's marrying either a creed or an institution. And so Jesus made being a disciple very personal. He made himself the issue. He put himself in the center of the ring. And he says, you, come follow me. You say, well, you know, that was fine for them. That was the first century. But, like, I've never even seen Jesus. And that's one of the strange things about following Christ is you don't have a lot of physicality to deal with. And a lot of us struggle with that. Some days I struggle with that more than others. Wouldn't it be nice if he would just show up in person and we could have this conversation? Sometimes you feel like you're in more of a monologue than you are a dialogue with the Lord. Peter must have sensed something of this because in 1 Peter chapter 1, he once reminded his readers that even though they hadn't seen Christ, they still loved him. It was a relationship. There was a personal side to it. So that's the first thing Jesus was doing when he said, come follow me. He was calling people to himself. The next thing that he was doing, he was calling people to participation in his mission. Jesus had a mission. He had a task. He had a job to do. By calling people to himself, he was calling them to participation that at times would be costly. I like it when people call me to things that are easy. You know, you call me up and you say, hey, Terry, what are you doing tonight? And then I kind of hesitate a little, not quite sure how to answer that question. I kind of like it, though, and you might too, when people call you to things that are not too costly. Jesus called people to himself and to a participation in his ministry that was sometimes costly. His intention, and he was very upfront with this, he said, I want to mess with you. I want to change you. Come follow me, he said, and I will make you fishers of men. Now, they understood this fishing business, but they didn't understand man fishing. They didn't understand people fishing. And that's why they needed an apprentice, or why they needed a journeyman to teach them what that entailed and how to do that. He says, I want to redirect your life. Truth be told, he was going to disrupt their lives as they knew it. And one of the first lessons that they discovered, and the passage talks about it, is that sometimes new loyalties supersede old loyalties. What does Mark tell us here that the fellows did after Jesus spoke to them? In verse 18, it says, at once they left their nets. And that stands for something, doesn't it? That would be like, you know, Fred leaving his hammers. And for some of you, leaving your computers. And I'm not suggesting here that this is the shape that discipleship always takes. Sometimes it doesn't. I'm sure we all know people for whom leaving occupation was part of their allegiance to Christ. Sometimes they had to leave arrangements. In verse 20, it says, without delay, he called them and they left their father. Two of these guys left their father, Zebedee, in the boat with the hired men and followed him. I'd love to have been there. I'd like to have heard the soundtrack. I wondered what Zebedee said under his breath. Hey, we've got work to, you know. And away they went. And you read some of the other gospels and it seems like these four fishermen actually were part of a fishing partnership. And so there was this arrangement that had been entered into and now somebody shows up, Jesus, who is this Jesus guy? And he exercises his authority. He says, come follow me. And old claims are being superseded by new ones. Again, I refer you to the analogy of marriage. In marriage, a man's responsibility is to please his wife. Woe to the man who forgets that. Before Harry got married, every Tuesday night, he went to his mom's and he ate her delicious lasagna. Now that he's married, his mom still expects him to come on Tuesday to sample her lasagna. But Harry's wife has different plans. Woe to Harry if he doesn't realize that new loyalties supersede old ones. Part of what I gather from this is that Jesus never intended to be a solo fisher. He came and he had a mission. Okay? He was out to gather people. He was a people gatherer. He was here to gather people to God. But Jesus never intended to be a solo gatherer. And so he calls apprentices. Now, he could have done it himself. Probably would have been a lot faster if he would have used his miraculous powers to do that in particular. It would have been a lot quicker. There are some jobs that if you don't have to teach your kids to help you do it, it just goes a lot more smoothly. But Jesus wasn't prepared to be a solo fisher. He desired to equip others to share in the work. In fact, in the Bible, there's an expression, co-workers. We are co-workers with God. And in the first or second century, when scribes were transmitting the scriptures so that other churches would have copies of them, they came to this expression in 2 Corinthians, and they didn't like it. They just thought, that is too bold. Somebody made a mistake, and they either dropped it or put another word in just to sort of soften it. Jesus, God, refers to us as his co-workers. Some days, do you think maybe he made a mistake? Wouldn't there have been a more efficient way of doing this? So he calls people to costly participate in his mission. Third thing, so he calls us to himself, he calls us to his mission, and then thirdly, he calls people into his circle. I love this thing called family circle. And I really marvel at the way some of you all are able to exercise gifts of hospitality, and in so doing you enlarge the circle. You know, new people come into your home, and let's put a few more plates on the table. You just have this amazing ability to welcome people and to enlarge your circle. And in a sense, that's what Jesus was doing here. He was creating a family circle, and he was, you know, the head of that circle. But there are other people that would be part of that circle. So he invites us into a fellowship with himself, like a family circle. When these first disciples said yes to Jesus, they automatically fell in with other disciples. Now, we know that these disciples didn't always get along. We know that they didn't always have the same background. We know that they didn't always agree on Jesus' choice of who else would be at the table. And yet, that's kind of who they were stuck with. You can choose your friends, but you can't choose your family. And so here they were. And in Mark chapter 3, there's this amazing list of the first 12 members of the family. It wasn't a nameless, faceless society. I mean, these are people who had names. And Mark, you know, went to the trouble. He could have just said, and there were 12 of them. But he doesn't do that. He says, there was Simon Peter, and there was James. There was his brother John, and they had a nickname, Sons of Thunder. There was Andrew, Philip, Bartholomew, Matthew, Thomas, James, Thaddeus, Simon, and, of course, the infamous Judas Iscariot. These people had names. It's not just meet the family. It's meet 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. You look around this morning, this is your family. For better or for worse, this is who you got. This is the team. The team needs us. We need the team. It's a circle. Jesus inserted us into the circle. So I take it that Jesus not only intended to be a solo fisher, but he never intended that we would work solo. He didn't want us to work alone. He didn't want us to be lone wolves. Some of us have temperaments that are lone wolf temperaments. We tend to withdraw. We tend to be introverts. And that's okay. I mean, God made us that way. It's just that we have to recognize that there are times when we need to join the group. Some people are already there. I mean, they haven't left the table. They just love being with the group. And some of us who have lone wolf tendencies, we need to come back to the table with great frequency. And perhaps this morning is a case in point, coming and breaking bread together. Jesus didn't intend for us to work alone, and he didn't intend that we would fish alone. He wants us to fish together. A number of years ago, some friends of mine asked me if I wanted to hike the West Coast Trail. And I'd heard about this, and I thought, well, that would be a challenge. And I had to train for it and get ready for it, I think, maybe the Wings have a son who just completed the West Coast Trail. And it was just one of those things, you know, one of those boxes. I put a tick beside it after I did it. Good, that's done. Don't need to do it again. But the literature that you read that prepares you for the journey of the West Coast Trail specifically says, do not attempt to do this alone. Well, why do you think that would be? Don't do the journey alone. Well, we found out one of the reasons for it. Halfway through the trip, one day we looked over on an escarpment and we saw what looked like a really big cat. It was a cougar. And apparently cougars, being predators, are drawn to the lone traveler. Don't hike the West Coast Trail alone. Don't try to fish alone. Don't try to do ministry alone. Don't try to do life alone. God never intended that we should work that way. So, in a nutshell, that's what I think Jesus was doing when he said, follow me. Yes, repent. Yes, believe. But then there's that other thing that we need to do as well. We need to take up our place as apprentices under the journeyman Jesus, as he calls people to himself, as he calls people to participate in his mission. Now remember his mission. His mission was a people gathering mission. There's all kinds of things that we can do that might not really qualify as people gathering mission. And we're not saying those other things aren't important, that they don't need to be done, but the central activity that Jesus calls us to is a people gathering ministry. And that's the one that we often tend to leave till last, or the one that scares the willies out of us, and so we don't do it. Brenda was talking earlier about leaving your zone of comfort. Ooh. You know, this is sounds like I might have to meet people, you know, I might have to get to know people. And the good news is that it's not nearly as impossible as we sometimes have convinced ourselves it is. So for take home, three things. Because the times that we're living in have an urgency to them. I don't know if you feel anything urgent this morning, but there is an urgency, and that is that God is poised to act. There is yet another great deliverance to come, and when that commences, it's kind of like, okay, chances are up. So whatever needs to happen before that moment. Three things. First, how do we view ourselves? We often see Jesus as our own personal Savior, and we should. I wonder how Jesus sees us. I wonder if he sees us as his own personal apprentices. And if I believe that Jesus saw me as his own personal apprentice, I wonder if that would, you know, make me wonder a little bit about, ooh, what would that look like? What am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to know? What are the basic skills that are entailed in being an apprentice of Jesus? What is it that I would need to know if I'm going to participate in this mission of gathering people in, which Jesus assumes all of his disciples will? He thinks of us as his own personal apprentice. How's your apprenticeship going? What's been happening in your apprenticeship lately? What's the journeyman been talking about? The second thing is, I know there are many ways of gauging our on mission with Jesus progress. One of them, I think, is conversation. I'm always interested in the conversation of a group. Like, what's our group talk like? You know, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of us get together. What do we talk about? Or when we have an AGM, what do we talk about? Is there a topic that sort of dominates the conversation? I know when I get around fishermen, Alan Tikurta, boy, he has got some stories about, you know, he's got stories about the last one, and he's got stories about the next one, and then he's got stories about the ones that got away. And I know when I'm around fishermen, because they just like to talk about fishing stuff. And what would it be like being around people who have bought into participating with Jesus in this gathering people to God sort of mission? I imagine there would be some, what would you call them? People, what did we call it before? People fishing stories, like Fred was sharing earlier about a friend, a workmate, a neighbor, whatever. This is just, wouldn't it be wonderful if like this was just totally normal, eh? It's just, we're always doing it. Some of you are doing it a lot. Some of us maybe don't do it that much. So that's one way I think that we can gauge our on mission with Jesus' progress, is our corporate conversation. A third way is to make ourselves available for the holy work of people fishing. That's the word, people fishing. to make ourselves available for the holy work of people fishing. There's so many ways of doing this. A number of months ago, the chapel was involved in an Alpha course. I don't know what you think about the Alpha course or, you know, what you thought about how well it went here at Balmoral. The thing I really liked about Alpha is that it sort of keeps important issues on the front burner. Keeps us thinking about, you know, what God is like. He extends himself beyond himself. He's always doing that. He's always extending himself beyond himself, and he calls us to come and join him and to mimic that where we live, work, and play. And so coming out of that, some of us thought, well, maybe it would be helpful if we, you know, got some of those people together and we formed a little group called Next Steps, and we just wanted to keep the spirit of Alpha alive. There was nothing earth-shattering that was discussed, nothing, I think, overly scary that happened, but we just talked about how better to support each other in, you know, this work of people fishing, which apparently was why Jesus came, and which is why he calls us to himself to develop the skills and so on, the priorities and the values to do this. So next fall, you might hear some things about the Next Step group, and I hope some of you will say, hey, I might be interested in being part of that. Jesus called me to be a people fisher. I don't know what you think about that, but he called you and me. Even those of us who don't have gifts of so-called evangelism, I'm one of them. He called us to be people fishers. What would that look like? How would we do that? And how would we do it together? And how could we encourage each other to keep what tends to slip onto the back burner, to keep it on the front burner? Thank you, Father, for this day in Galilee when Jesus encountered these commercial fishermen, used language that they understood, and invited them to himself and to participate in his mission and to do it with other folk who recognized Jesus the same way that they did. Pray that you do a mighty work here at Balmoral, and that we would resist the temptation to become overly inward focused, that we would be less about ourselves and increasingly more about others who don't yet know Christ. Thank you for putting us in the neighborhoods where we are, for putting us in the places of work where we are, for putting us in gymnasiums and malls and in all sorts of places. And we pray that you would continue your good work of transforming us as apprentices of Jesus.